Hello, Barry. Maurice Solotow speaking here. I've received your questions, and I'll try to answer them to the best of my memory. Let me say first, in case I forget about this, among the students, one was a graduate student and one was an undergraduate, whom I met during my freshman year and knew later in life at odd times, were two men who made a very significant mark in American culture. The first happened to live in Haywood House during this period of 1931-32. He was A.L. Maslow, or Abe Maslow, M-A-S-L-O-W. And he, of course, later attained fame as a psychologist and was very active in the human awareness movement, the consciousness of movement, all the things related to the California groups. And he, toward the end of his life, worked in an institute, I think connected with Stanford at Menlo Park. He, at the time I met him, I believe, going for his master's degree in psychology, and he was a research worker for the famous Professor Harlow Shapley. Yes, I think that's, I hope I have him, there was an astronomer with that name, I may have them mixed up. But this psychology professor did very, very important research in the importance of warm physical contact between mother monkeys, I believe chimpanzees, and babies. And he made tests with a wire monkey and a cloth monkey that had become very significant and quite famous in psychological circles. And I remember Abe Maslow as a kind of a very hungry, starving young undergraduate describing the work in the laboratory, and that there was so little money available for these studies that the students working for the professor had to go around to markets, because there were no supermarkets in 1931 and 1932, just the fruit stores and grocery stores, and get sort through the garbage outside these stores and get lettuce that had slightly spoiled, lettuce and other vegetables that had been thrown away to feed to these monkeys being tested in the experiment. He was one of the colorful characters of that time, who was in a sense a bohemian. I think we have to be careful. You have to remember, first of all, that I wrote the piece that you read in the American Mercury when I was just a few years out of school myself and was not as mature as I became later, and certainly not as objective about my college years. But I think there was a great feeling of personal freedom and breaking bonds in the air, which we all had at that time. And one of the advantages that we had, I believe, which may seem ironic to you, is that there was no government involvement in our lives, very little, let us say. So nobody had, very few had grants and were dependent on placating people. You could go your own way in obscurity. There was no medium focus on individuals who were eccentric or individualistic or who were radical or who were conservative. There was no television cameras focusing on us. Nobody interviewed us. We were left alone, more or less. You had to do something quite obstreperous to get any attention at all. And I think this was one of the great, great advantages we had. We could work out our goals, our desires, struggling with ourselves, in ourselves, and not have to try to play the television cameras. I know during the 60s I became so aware, because of my own children, especially my daughter, who was quite involved with the Yippies and Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, how much of what they did was either unconsciously or deliberately planned to get the attention of the media, which made for a very corrupting kind of influence, I think. Now, the other student who had a great impact on American life, later, subsequently, was the poet and writer Delmore Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, and there's a biography of Delmore by James Atlas, I think Little Brown published it, in which I told some of my experiences with Delmore. We were rather close friends at Wisconsin, and he then already, even though a young man of 17, was not only a fine poet, already writing avant-garde poetry, but was had a remarkable range of knowledge of the European and American poets, the English poets, the American poets. It was he that first told me about Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. And it's incredible now, if you were to talk to English majors now, but at that time, even though Eliot and Pound were two of the most important poets writing in the English language, James Joyce, of course, had already written Ulysses and Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist. Almost the entire English faculty, except for one lady, Ethel Thornbury, was totally out of touch with the developments that were taking place in poetry and prose. It's extraordinary to look back at it. We were encouraged by our professors, but I can remember one English professor, full professor, who could not complain to me, couldn't understand a rather simple poem by T.S. Eliot. And again, I want to say these were not writers in manuscript. These were already famous writers, but the professors we had were still bogged down in the pre-World War writers. They had gotten about as far as the Imagist movement. I realize I may be going into areas that mean nothing to you, but because you probably a history major. So there was, again, a sense of personal discovery that we had. Today, from what I know of undergraduates, the professors are often more revolutionary and radical than the students. And perhaps the student of today who wants to make a break and express himself has to become a neoconservative or an anti-Marxist, or perhaps an anti-experimental poet. I don't know. It's just a curious difference between life as it was. You asked later one of the questions about did it change between my freshman year and the later years. No. Life at the university remained about the same. Until the war came, of course, by then I had been graduated. I think one of the things I might suggest for you to check into, I mentioned Abe Maslow. I don't know whether in any of his writings he speaks of the university or whether any letters are extant. He died several years ago. Delmore Schwartz is dead. I would suggest that if you check back issues of the Cardinal, because between somewhere around 1934, 1935, 1936, I wrote a column twice a week for the Cardinal called Fair is Foul. And my column attempted to reflect the daily life of the campus. It was and it delved into everything. For example, when Gertrude Stein came to America, and gave a lecture, I I wrote a column defending her. I was the only about the only voice in Madison, including the Capital Times and the State Journal, that defended her. She was widely ridiculed everywhere. I only remember this because the Alumni magazine ran an article recalling her visit by a contributor who went back and quoted my columns. You'll also find columns I wrote about the Oxford Peace Movement, which I believe was something that was very prominent in England and America during the 1935, 1936, in which people, students at Cambridge and Oxford in England and students here, pledged that they would never fight in another war. In many ways, it's reminiscent of the nuclear freeze movement now and the peace movement now, or the peace movement during the Vietnam War. And the column I wrote was a kind of an eerie prediction, because I said when the next war happens, all of us will be marching and fighting again. And of course, that worked out that way, alas. But anyway, let me try to answer your questions in some sort of order. The first question is about Haywood House. It began in 1931. I don't know precisely how it began. I wish I could give you the name of some of the radicals who lived there, either men or women. It was located in some street around University Avenue toward Randall Stadium. It was a two-story frame house, and I don't remember what how tenants were selected, who owned the house. I do remember this. There was no upkeep. There were no house rules. It was a very messy, fun place. There were no requirements for membership. The party things, communist party things, were very loose at that time. 1931 was the year the National Student League was formed. I was one of its founding members in Madison. And that was a Communist Party front organization. But it was the first time there was some attempt made to organize college students who had a Stalinist or Marxist orientation. The Young People's Socialist League still was active. You must remember that the state of Wisconsin had always had a very strong socialist movement. They had elected a socialist mayor in Milwaukee before World War I. I know that people of your generation perhaps think that the real radicalization, the left-wing radicalization of America began in the 1960s. But if you go back and study the period before World War I, you would be astonished at the number of socialists, Marxists. A publication called Appeal to Reason had over 1 million circulation, a weekly publication. I think it was edited by Upton Sinclair. It was a straightforward socialist publication. I would say that in terms of population change, that would be surely equivalent to a paper that had 5 million today. I believe there were 5 or 6 congressmen from the state of Wisconsin who were members of the Socialist Party, elected on the socialist ticket, elected as Marxists, as people who believed in the public ownership of all means of production. One of them was a famous congressman named Victor Berger, who attained some sort of notoriety because he voted against America's entrance into World War I. It was a very strong pacifist movement in Wisconsin. Of course, as we know, the La Follette progressive movement was very strong. So you wouldn't have the feeling about Haywood House and its people. They were rather scruffy people. They were a mixture of bohemians, in the sense of artistic bohemians, and political leftists or political Marxists, some of whom were very, very bright, others of whom just were in for socializing. There was mixed men and women, and that's about all I remember about it. There was no animosity toward Hayward House by the neighbors, community, or the university. I don't think it lasted more than 2 years. But if you delve into it deeply enough, I'm sure you'd be able to uncover half a dozen radicals then who are still alive and have memories of it. I didn't live there. Okay. Your next question concerns the Cardinal. To me, one of the biggest differences of the Cardinal during the period before the Second World War, and even more so before the 1960s, is that the Daily Cardinal, as you can see if you go back and take the issues, tried to operate as a real newspaper. It wasn't a propaganda sheet. It wasn't personal opinion paper, except for columns, byline columns, the kind of thing I wrote. And it attempted on a small scale to imitate and prepare one for how one would act and behave if one became a professional journalist. Some of us went to the School of Journalism, which at that time was one of the three or four best in the country. There was a Columbia School of Journalism, a Wisconsin School of Journalism, and I believe University of Missouri had a good school of journalism. There were professional schools at that time were not as enormous as they are now, and of course there was no particular talk about communications and all these, and theater arts and film arts. The great proliferation of academic facilities is one of the remarkable things to me. The Cardinal, the staff of the Cardinal, by and large, it attracted men and women who really were interested in ultimately in having careers as newspapermen, as perhaps as fiction writers, as novelists, as short story writers, as magazine article writers, because I myself personally had already known by the time I was in high school that I wanted to be a writer for the rest of my life. And the people who I admired, like Ernest Hemingway, the preceding generation of writers, like Ernest Hemingway, were foreign correspondents who were very, John Reed was one that I admire, had all begun their careers as journalists. And that's what I hope to do, get a job in a newspaper. And the Daily Cardinal was a terrific paper. It was well organized and staffed, edited, managed. Assignments were given out. There was a news department. Every aspect of student life was covered, and covered well, and written about well. That included sports, of course, and academic coverage, news about students and professors, and events that happened on campus. It was a daily paper. It came out 5 times a week, and the difference between the Daily Cardinal during the 1930s, when I knew it and worked on it, and the Daily Cardinal that I saw on visits I made to the campus in the late 60s, and I was there about 5 or 6 years ago, are just enormous. It's just, they were different types of journals. So that the later Cardinal, I don't know what the Cardinal is now at this moment, but the later Cardinal had more resemblance to an underground paper like the Phoenix of Boston, let's say, than it did to a newspaper like the New York Times. And we of that generation hoped ultimately to make careers in the newspaper business or profession. And as a matter of fact, I remember quite a few men and women that I knew who later went on to careers in the Associated Press, in newspapers. Some well-known people include Howard Teichman, T-E-I-C-H-M-A-N, who became a playwright and has written biographies of George S. Kaufman and Alexander Wilka. He was a Cardinal staff person. Robert Chaplin, S-H-A-P-L-E-N, who is still Far East correspondent of the New Yorker magazine, was on the staff of the Cardinal at that time. Daniel Lang, L-A-N-G, who died about 2 or 3 years ago, was also a staff writer for the New York Magazine, and he was one of the first general interest writers to cover the developments in atomic energy and describe the atomic scientists, and many of his essays were published in books. I'm sure there are many more people, but let me go on to your next question, the experimental college. I'm taking a break now and we'll come back. Hello. I'm picking this up again after a couple of weeks away from it, and I believe we were talking about the Haywood House. So I think I've, in case I didn't quite make it clear before, just let me say that regarding the question, the attitude toward Haywood House by Neighbors Communion University, they ignored it. It didn't make any great impact. It was just one of a number of boarding houses, and they didn't pay any particular attention to it. It was just a kind of a loose conglomeration of guys and gals. Let me give you two names of people who either were living in Haywood House or were close to it and may have be able to answer some of your questions. They both happen to be California people. I'll give you the last addresses I have. One is Sidney Brenner, B-R-E-N-N-E-R. He's now a psychotherapist. The last address I have for him is 218 Avenida del Norte, Redondo Beach, California, R-E-D-O-N-D-O. Dondo Beach, California, 9277. Another one was Amram Katz, K-A-T-Z. I believe he became a physicist. I only have a California phone number for him, 213-394-8818. All right, now let's, as to what happened to Haywood House, I think it more or less went the way of such things after 2 or 3 years. It was in some ways similar to utopian colonies of the 19th and early 20th century, and I guess many of the hippie communes in the 60s. Okay, question two is student publications. At that time, we had a humor monthly, Octopus. That was very fashionable on campuses all over the country. From it, many, many professional playwrights came, lyricists, etc. The Daily Cardinal was a terrific paper. It was a, I think it was read by everybody, or almost everybody on the campus. It was, came out 5 times a week. It covered all the activities. There was a kind of a, it's hard to sum up whole period, university then as now attracts a broad spectrum of people with many with diverse interests, but it seems to me, looking back and contrasting it with the little I know of students of later generations, particularly the activist 1960s and early 70s, that people, students didn't seem to be that limited. My work on the Daily Cardinal, in my freshman year, I just did general assignments. It was organized like a professional newspaper, with an editor, a managing editor, city editor, assignments, features, a very good sports department. Robert Chaplin, S-H-A-P-L-E-N, was a sports writer. He was on the staff. He is still the Far Eastern correspondent for the New Yorker magazine, has written many articles. Daniel Lang, L-A-N-G, was also on the staff of the Cardinal. He became a professional writer in later life and also was on the staff of the New Yorker. He covered a lot of the early atomic physics story. Howard Teichman, T-E-C-H-M-A-N, was also on the staff of the Cardinal in my time and a friend. He later became a playwright, biographer, and so forth, and a teacher. His most recent book is a collaboration with Henry Fonda. I would say the type of student the Cardinal attracted was a person who, a man or a woman, who wanted to be a professional writer ultimately, or a professional journalist. And at that time, journalism had a very high romantic attraction for people. It was the era of the foreign correspondent. Vincent Sheehan's books were bestsellers. It was the era of John Gunther, the Civil War in Spain. There was something romantic about being a newspaper man, a journalist. Maybe it was a hangover of the front page period. So it attracted somebody who had a sort of bohemian flair. Again, I'm stressing, I suppose I'm overdoing the bohemian element, but I felt this, as I said in that article in the Mercury that you dug up, the flavor of freedom was very powerful, and it went through everything, I think, even in the fraternities and sororities. It was a great atmosphere of freedom and a willingness to think about any idea and discuss any idea. When I began to write a column for the Daily Cardinal, which you might check out, by the way, you would find that many of my ideas were unconventional with some of the leftist students, like I would defend fraternities sometimes, and et cetera. I won't tell you all this. You can find, if you check, I think an excellent idea would be for you to check the Daily Cardinal, let's say, from 1934 to 1936. I think you would get a vivid idea of the things, what we considered, why, and the editors considered the stories on campus. Everything was covered, not just politics. Incidentally, before I wandered too much away, the man I was called Harlow Shapley is really Harry Harlow, and Abraham L. Maslow is certainly somebody you might look into as having been, I think, a resident of Haywood House and one of Harry Harlow's students, and would later become a very influential philosopher and thinker. The poet Delmore Schwartz was a friend of mine, and he already was writing avant-garde poetry. There was a whole group of artistic bohemians. There were political bohemians, there were journalism bohemians, there were poetic and music bohemians, and Delmore Schwartz was one of them. And before he was 17, already had set his feet on the path that he was to walk so successfully. I suggest you check out the biography of Delmore Schwartz by James Atlas, which was published, I think, by Little Brown about 2 or 3 years ago. It has at least one chapter, as I recall it, about Delmore at the University of Wisconsin. Now, there was the English department had a residence house for women, Arden House, and there was which served lunch and dinner. And the Arden House sponsored a group which met once a week called the Arden Club. And this attracted many, many of the young men and women who wanted to be poets and writers. The faculty advisor was Don Hayakawa, or S. Ichia Hayakawa, who was then a graduate student going for his PhD in English, and had a whole coterie of students that he inspired them and encouraged them and stimulated them. And he read their poetry. Delmore occasionally went to the Arden Club. I went to the Arden Club. And we were very excited about contemporary English and American poetry. And I must say, we're way, way ahead of the faculty. I can remember in 1935 and 1936 already talking about and reading W.H. Auden, C. Day Lewis, Stephen Spender. Among the bohemians, remember, political bohemians should not be forgotten. If you define bohemia as a basically free-swinging, independently-minded attitude, I think that's what I mean. I don't necessarily mean raggle-taggle idiots. Now, for the experimental college, by the way, a man named Irving Fine, who also is resident in California, and lived in the experimental college, and kept up his connections with many of the people who went there. His address is 1100 North Alta Loma, Los Angeles, 90069. His phone number is 657-5000. Another significant name is a psychotherapist, I think he's in retirement now, named Spira, Bert Spira, S-P-I-R-A. He lives in Newport Beach, California. I think you can probably trace him through the American Psychiatric Association. Let's see. Another student publication that I was involved with was The Rocking Horse, which now on and off the university has had literary publications, and this was a very important one for several years, and one of my earliest pieces of writing appeared in print in The Rocking Horse, and Don Hayakawa, who, as you probably know, later became a Republican senator from the state of California, and prior to that had become a noted semanticist. I should mention here that there was a very close relationship, not just between graduate students, who were now would be called teaching assistants, but then had titles like assistant instructors, and students. There was a give and take also between undergraduates, even at the sophomore level, with full professors. We were invited to their houses. For example, a professor that had a great influence on me, another student, was a professor of French named Samuel Rogers. He influenced me in understanding Marcel Proust, for example, and wanting to follow the profession of writer. He was a serious writer and very intense and wonderful professor. And he had written a novel called Dusk at the Grove that had won a $10,000 prize given by the Atlantic Monthly. Helen C. White, after whom a building is named, was an inspiration and a friend, and she was a woman who published novels. I think it's interesting to see one of the characteristics of the teachers at that period is that there was a human relationship between student and teacher, a true relationship. They were teachers in the sense of almost like gurus and disciples or masters and disciples. They cared about you, and you could talk about your personal problems. They would lend you money. They would feed you, as well as discuss your writing aspirations and your love problems. I know that Helen White tried to be very kind to myself and a lady named Charlotte, who I was going with at the time and whom I later married, and who herself became a writer. I think that element has gone out of life at the university, was campus life, because the campus is too large, perhaps, and because professors in all the disciplines and all the subjects are anxious to do research and publishing. But I remember Abe Maslow, for example, talking about Professor Harlow as a friend, as if he was a guru, and not some remote, forbidding person that you heard about only indirectly. One of the very influential personalities on the campus was a philosophy professor named Max Otto, O-T-T-O. He taught a course called Man and Nature, in which he took a rather freewheeling attitude toward God and religion. And of course, William Ellery Leonard, I discussed in my piece. So there was a very definite feeling of an atmosphere of writers and thinkers and people who said what they wanted to say and thought what they wanted to say, and a very extraordinary give and take. Now, the experimental college, I'm going on to your next category. I was not a student at the experimental college. When I went to the university in the fall of 1931, they were winding up the last year. The ex-college was a two-year program, and I thought I would be in it, but it was winding up its last year. However, parts of the dormitory houses in Adams Hall, and were still occupied by ex-college students. In the house I was assigned to, Fayville House, most of the students there were ex-college students. Students I met, strangely enough, and got to know very well, because in those days in Fayville House, all the residents of Fayville House, of course, they were all men. We had a proctor in each house, and we sat at the same table in the dining room. Each house sat at its table. There was a sit-down meal set up, which again was conducive to conversation and interchange of ideas. The present kind of helter-skelter cafeteria arrangement, I understand it, but it doesn't quite have the same feeling. And undergraduate students would wait on tables and receive part of their room and board in exchange for this. There were very strict visiting hours, of course, in the dormitory at that period of time. There were the women's dormitory and women's residences. During the week, there were 10:30. They had to be home by 10:30. And weekends, Friday and Saturday, were 12:30 nights. But these curfews were observed very strictly. The men's residences and dormitories had no curfews, but you could not bring women there except on Sunday, and the door had to be open at least 4 inches or something. I don't remember the exact thing. Okay, back to the experimental college. I'd say it struck me at that time that the students I knew did not work, lacked discipline, and it turned me very strongly against progressive education, so strongly that when later on I got married and had children, I would never have any, as much as possible, I didn't want them to get progressive education, progressive teachers. I came to the conclusion that young men and young women must have some sort of discipline, structure, and responsibility. Otherwise, they would tend to do a great deal of fucking off, screwing up, getting very flaky. Now, there may be a cause and effect here. It's hard to say, was it the lack of structure in the experimental college that made the students flaky, or were they flaky to begin with? I'm not sure. That's a tremendous subject in itself. Alexander Micklejohn and the other faculty members were brilliant people. I didn't know any of them except Agard. Walter Agard was remarkable. I took third year Greek with Mr. Agard. I personally wanted to know Greek. By the way, as you know, the idea of the ex-college was to study Greek civilization for 1 year, and then American civilization for 1 year, and then you could do anything you wanted and get your, you could write. One person I knew, Mr. Fine, that I mentioned, well, wrote a novel as his thing. You could do any study. So it was very free. And there are very few men who are 16, 17, 18 years old who can use freedom properly. You first have to be dependent before you can be independent. Agard was a great teacher and a wonderful person. Oh, I was going to say that of all the, I only knew one person. Of all the people at the experimental college, the year I was there, I was at UW as a freshman, who bothered to learn Greek language, and were able to read Greek. So all they did was read Homer and Plato in translation. My desire to learn Greek was just a capricious urge that had nothing to do with the experimental college. All right, now we go on to the music room. But again, the point I keep coming back to is that because of the nature of the experimental college, and because of the nature of Alexander Micklejohn and Glenn Frank, through the whole university, there was a feeling of freedom and of liberation. No boundaries, no bonds. So that has a positive side. And at that time, that was, I think we were unique among universities. Even to compare it to Berkeley during the 1960s, to me is insufficient, because Berkeley's rebellions and demonstrations and meetings were very much on a public level. We had a few during this, let's say, my freshman year and later, public demonstrations. But there was also tremendous inner exploration, inner growth, seeking, reading, tremendous amount of reading and discussion. One of the dreadful things that the sexual revolution brought was it seemed to confine discussions between men and women to one subject, sex. And at that time it was meetings of the Arden Club, for example, where men and women met as people who loved poetry. They also loved sex, of course, and the Lake Road was a popular trysting place, as was Observatory Hill, but they shared a great many other things. However, that's so much for the experimental college. I think if you contact some people who are still living and were there, you will find many who can have vivid memories of it. One of the interesting things about going to UW in the 1930s was that nobody had automobiles. I knew only one person in all of Adams Hall who had an automobile, or rather the use of an automobile. He was dating a woman who was a Ringling, the Baraboo, Wisconsin Ringling circus family, and she had a convertible car, and they would drive around. He was the envy of everybody. Once in a while, you would rent a car for a heavy date, a formal date. In my house, in Fable House, there was only one privately owned radio. That was owned by a guy in the experimental college named Walter Brecher, B-R-E-C-H-E-R, who I believe is still alive, whose parents owned, and he now owns, movie theaters in New York City that show foreign films. So you might be able to trace him down through the Alumni Association. But I think one of the things, advantages we had, we walked a lot, because we didn't have cars, we had to walk, which is a very healthy and invigorating thing to do, and it's good for the mind. The campus was uncrowded. One of the first things that strikes an alumnus like myself when he comes back is that not just the new buildings, which I think are rather ugly and kind of look like condominiums in Miami Beach and places like that, but the cars and cars and cars and parking space. If you can just use your imagination, imagine how beautiful this campus was when all the modern buildings that now exist on it were not there, when the lower campus near State Street was just beautiful and peaceful, and there were no automobiles. The streets were uncluttered. There were very, very few cars. And the places where you live were quiet and peaceful. There wasn't a tremendous racket of stereo sets and phonographs and radios. And it was just, there was one radio, and that was in the den in the Fable House. That's all, except the one Wally Brecher owned. And you didn't have television, of course. But let's not get off into television. All right, I meant the music room still exists, although I don't know. But the music room was just wonderful. It was the corner room of the Memorial Union building. It had a K-Part automatic phonograph, which was a remarkable thing. And you just went to the cloak room and took records out. I remember people were very, there were several people who, it was mostly romantic symphonies of the 19th century, Tchaikovsky, Brahms, Beethoven. There was very little or no Baroque music. Today, if you had something like that, there would be a great deal of Vivaldi and Bach and so forth. People in the music room, people listened to music, talked, gossiped. You ask what topics they might have conversations about. The time of day was usually the late afternoon. The topics could concern everything from, I remember a beautiful blonde Danish gal in the music room noticing I had a copy of Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov under my arm or in my lap, and she started a conversation about Dostoevsky, and we talked about Dostoevsky. On the other hand, you might talk about unemployment, you might talk about the political matters, the state of Wisconsin, certainly those that were in the National Students League had just been formed. That was a communist front organization or a Marxist organization. There was a socialist club. There was a, remember the Progressive Party was still strong. I believe they had a La Follette club. The La Follette still had a great deal of prestige. And you might discuss, I don't remember food being discussed very much. It's curious. You would think at a time when we didn't have much money, people would talk a lot about food, but there wasn't much food. There was talk about drinking places. Remember, at this period, between 1931 and 1932, we still had prohibition. So people might talk about favorite speakeasies. The speakeasies on Regent Street were favorite hangouts of every category of Bohemians, including fraternity people who, you know, wanted to get things to drink. And there were places like Lohmeyer's, L-O-H-M-A-I-E-R-S, right on State Street, many of them, which served illegal concoctions. For example, one of them had etherized beer. It was a common thing among speakeasies. They would put small amounts of ether into near beer, which was legal, and spike it up. Or you could put alcohol into beer. And there were a couple of these on State Street, wide open, by the way. Whereas on Regent Street, you had a whole string of speakeasies that were in the basements of people's houses. And I, in the second or third month of my freshman year, picking up on side two now. I got drunk with several friends and staggering home. You have to remember, it was fairly chilly and probably a 2-3 mile walk back to the campus uphill, which one just didn't mind it. It was just a normal thing to do because Adams Hall is quite a far distance from Regent Street. And singing the International at the top of my lung, the Rise You Prisoners of Starvation, getting picked up by the cops. Sidney Brenner was let go. There was a fellow named Gene Loveman, later killed in the Spanish Civil War. He and I were arrested. Delmore Schwartz, this was Saturday night, and Delmore Schwartz heard about it, and he didn't have any money. They wanted $25 bail money, and he went to Bird Spira, the psychiatrist I mentioned, who was then a medical student, and who came from a wealthy Chicago family. Most of us counted the nickels, the dimes, the quarters, and the dollars. Very few had any large incomes. Anyhow, Bert Spira bailed me out of jail. I got out of jail Sunday, and there was a hearing Monday or Tuesday, and I was, being a minor, I still hadn't become 18 yet, I was released. It was a front page story in the Daily Cardinal. I was portrayed of something as a hero. And it was the second time, twice during my freshman year, I was arrested. The other case is quite interesting. There was a Communist Party leader in Wisconsin at that time named Elmer Luchterhand, L-E-U-C-H-T-E-R-H-A-N-D. And he was going up and down in the state from Milwaukee, northeast, stirring up unemployment. The unemployed, and they were having big demonstrations, and wherever he went, he was frequently arrested. So he came to Madison, Wisconsin, and they had a big demonstration. The Communist Party had set up groups called unemployment councils, and they had a big demonstration of unemployed, several thousand, somewhere in Madison, I forget the exact place, and he was arrested. Now, instead of putting him in jail, they sent him to the Mendota State Insane Asylum, or whatever it's called, across the lake. And I believe it's the first time on record the insanity was used as a political weapon. I remember there was an article about it either in The Nation or New Republic. Subsequently, ironically enough, the conception of a political dissenter as being insane was used against right-wing and reactionary people, like the famous General Walker case, crazy right-wing general who was arrested, but not arrested on civil or criminal charges, but put away as a mental patient. I don't know if you're acquainted with the writings of Thomas Szasz, S-Z-A-S-Z, who thinks he's a psychiatrist, but he thinks the profession is often misused. He has a book in which he mentions many of these cases. And of course, as we know, in the Soviet Union, political dissent is treated as a form of insanity, which maybe it is in societies like that. But anyhow, Elmer Luchterhand, comrade Luchterhand, was diagnosed as paranoid. He felt the police were after him. Well, they were after him. They kept clubbing him and arresting him and putting him in jail. Anyhow, we held a protest meeting, students and radicals of the city, socialists, communists, mainly communists, to protest the frame-up of Luchterhand. And I was just giving leaflets out. This is a strange thing to see the difference then and now. I wasn't throwing eggs at anybody or yelling obscenities at the police. I was just quietly giving out circulars door-to-door in a residential area of Madison, and I was picked up by the police. It was during the week or two before final exams, and somewhere around late, must have been June 1932, and I was kept in jail overnight. It shows you differences then and now. Well, that's a music room. So we have discussed hangouts. By the way, the Paul Bunyan Room was then, as it is now, a hangout of lots of people, and the Rathskeller was a hangout. Great hangout of all kinds of people who wanted places to hang out. I must say, I have a certain characteristic which you find among many men and women who become journalists. I was curious about a lot of things, and my life as an undergraduate went through many spectrum, many layers of university life. I had friends in the fraternity and sorority element. Especially my freshman year and later all through, hung out with political radicals and anarchists and just crazy nuts. And I had friendships with people whose main interest was literature and the arts, music, painting. And then there was another category of people who were straight out and out journalists and who were aiming for careers in journalism, as I was. And of course, one has personal interests. That you might have a friend who likes journalism, but I was already crazy about jazz, for example. And I discovered Louis Armstrong and people like that, Duke Ellington, who were not, again, very well known at the period. It was thrilling to find things for yourself which were not commercial yet. One of the characteristics of living in that period, the 30s, was the media didn't zero in on everything, kind of rob it of its vitality. Today, Christ, if I were a freshman and I were arrested for distributing leaflets, I'd be on the 5 o'clock news, and I'd be interviewed, and the People magazine would do an article about me, and Time magazine would write about a restless youth, and all of a sudden, my own validity and personal growth, and everything else is kind of minced up and chopped up and made into a hamburger for the media. And it's not true. It's true of television, it's true of newspapers, magazines, my own profession. And fads come and go very quickly. Celebrities live and die. Now in those days, 30s, well into the 40s even, you could quietly pursue an interest. I began collecting jazz records. I'd pick them up, old ones in thrift shops, for 5 or 10 cents a record. They were old blues records. Nobody wrote articles about it, but nobody. And so I say I had several friends who loved jazz. I had several friends who loved T.S. Eliot. And nobody was writing things about undergraduates who have discovered unconventional British and American poets, like Hart Crane. There was a great excitement and flavor to one's life, and a sense of exploring and sharing and discovering for yourself and sharing it with your friends. It was I hope that people today on the campus find equivalents of that, but the media spoils a great many things. We had, I'm getting to your next category, May Day, was an annual holiday, of course, a labor holiday, and that was the first time, to my knowledge, that the radical students tried to put on an actual show with skits. We had a double celebration. During the day, we met with workers' groups at a large park in the city. I can't remember where. And then at night, we got a room, I think in the Union, with the faculty permission, and we put on a show of skits, songs and dances about May Day. No admission was charged. We just did it as volunteers. What it symbolized to me and other people, I would say, is a lot like the flavor that Warren Beatty and Diane Keaton caught in the movie Reds. I and those friends who participated in these things, we were very close to the, in spirit and not too far removed in time, from Greenwich Village and the artistic revolts which had taken place in the United States before World War I and even more strongly after World War I. And I think we read and admired the lives of John Reed and Eugene O'Neill, this whole flavor which that film captured so well. That was what we were trying, I think, to reproduce in Haywood House, in the May Day celebration. We had protest rallies for Mooney and Billings, and they were spontaneous. They came from us spontaneously. I remember admiring Eugene O'Neill. I wrote a Marxist interpretation of Eugene O'Neill's plays and submitted it for the Lewis Prize. There were two main undergraduate composition prizes which people who were English majors like myself competed for. One for freshmen, the Lewis Prize, which I didn't win, and the other for seniors was called the Vilas Prize, which I did win. And I guess it shows how precocious, not just I, but a whole generation of men and women were, that I was able to already be so close to Eugene O'Neill in my freshman year that I wrote a long treatment of his plays for a freshman essay contest run by the English department. And my subject in the senior year was the achievement of T.S. Eliot. Now I'm talking of 1936 here, so by then the faculty was becoming more sympathetic, the English department, to the avant-garde poets. So I would say that was the kind of people we wanted to be and were trying to be in our clothes. We were unconventional. Some people went to Hoke and Dunn's and other fancy clothes shop, but we kind of thought people who dressed too well were fraternity and sorority, the Greeks we called them. And we were rather proud of unconventional apparel and unconventional attitude of getting drunk. But of course everybody got drunk. Getting drunk was a form of rebellion. But it's a lot. When I saw the movie Reds, I just felt as if it was almost about me, because I had really hoped that I could become somebody like John Reed in his personal life, in his writing, in the adventures he had, and in his relations with women and writers. And there seemed something very exciting about Greenwich Village existence, La Vie de Bohème. One of the first articles I sold when I became a professional journalist was to the New York Sunday Times Magazine. And it was about Greenwich Village, its past and present, strangely enough. So obviously, when you add that to this article I wrote in the American Mercury, you can see that I had a mind, my mind was already predisposed to be drawn to Bohemians. Very few, if any, members of the faculty, by the way, were involved in left-wing politics at that time. As far as I know, there was only one Communist Party member in the English department. He was an instructor that the radical students knew about, and he happened to be an alcoholic also. I didn't realize it at the time, but many with strange, remote qualities were alcoholic, those of an alcoholic. Politically, of course, there were a great many important progressives and liberals in the economics department, the law department, Lloyd Garrison. When Roosevelt was elected in 1932 and the New Deal began forming, it's fair to say that people from the University of Wisconsin faculty and recent graduates were a very important part in shaping the New Deal. Somebody you might get in touch with, it shouldn't be too hard to locate him, is the famous Wilbur Cohn, who ultimately became Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, and set up the whole social security system and the welfare system. He was an experimental college student, and he has very vivid memories, and he's very articulate. My recollection, the best of my recollection, he is a professor since he left politics and the administration. He's a professor somewhere, perhaps at the University of Michigan. He shouldn't be too hard to locate. He was one of many, many persons, men and women, who became very, very important in the as American life changed in the 1930s and 40s. And I honestly believe that the feelings and attitudes of a Abraham Maslow or a Wilbur Cohn were shaped by this feeling of freedom and caring and the winnowing and sifting of ideas that the University of Wisconsin has always espoused and was particularly open in espousing during this period of which we're talking about. You have to remember that by and large, even though the dean of men and the dean of women didn't approve of many of the ideas I and others espoused, we were never put down or expelled or thrown out or even put up on the carpet for it. It was accepted that Wisconsin was a place where you could do anything you wanted, no matter how outlandish, as long as you didn't interfere with other people's rights and you listened respectfully to their ideas. I think the concept of this concept of mutual respect was eroded during the 1960s, and so I'm a little appalled, well, I'm very appalled, more than a little, when I read that left-wing students today who were in spirit, I suppose, in many ways like I and my friends were, hoot down and boo people like Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick of the United Nations, because they don't, they want to shut her up and not let her express her startling ideas, or Ernest Shockley can't speak at a campus. It shouldn't be. There should be, and it wasn't then. So, Wilbur Cohen. There was a great difference. The question six is about classes. Yes, there was some change took place. My attitude toward classes in my freshman year was, my education was really not happening in class. It was happening off the campus. I wasn't a very hard-working student. I read a great deal. I wasn't wasting time. One of the things that characterized my feelings and that of many other people like me was an antipathy toward athletics. I had no interest in the football game or in sports. That wasn't true of everybody. Some of my closest friends, like Bob Chaplin, as I say, was a sports writer and knew sports. I wasn't a very good student. I didn't get good grades. I almost flunked zoology. You had to take a course. 1 year of science was compulsory, and I took zoology. I had a great deal of difficulty in the lab experiments, and I guess I butchered a dozen frogs. And now, I was out of school for a year. I was trying to work. I went to NYU for almost a year. When I came back to class, the college in the autumn of 1934, I had a total change. I became intensely interested in studying and in classes. They started a new program. My major was English. They started a new program called Reading for Honors in the English department. And you took in your junior and senior year, I was found to be eligible for it. You didn't have to go to any classes. It was almost like the experimental college in a sense. You had a tutor. My tutor was Ricardo Quintana, an authority on Jonathan Swift. And you met with him once a week. You had a list of basic books in English and American literature, which you would take a 6-hour written and a 1-hour oral at the end of the 2 years. You could audit any classes you wanted. And but this is what I did. And I worked very hard. One of the professors that influenced me the most among them was a man named Ryan. Both of them were very stiff, disciplinary professors. Another was a professor of Greek named Laird. I took first year Greek with him. Both of them made me work hard, fulfill assignments, and I feel I owe them a great deal. Helen C. White and Samuel Rogers, I have mentioned. Hayakawa, I've mentioned. There was a professor of philosophy who, I can't remember his name, and suddenly he taught a class on Dewey's Art as Experience, a graduate class, but he took a few undergraduates. In general, most of the unconventionals did not end up graduating from the University of Wisconsin. Many of them found transition from those who were the ex-college to the Hill, as we called it, Bascom Hall and its environs, impossible to make. And I think many of them became lifelong drifters and failures. However, a significant number, like Wilbur Cohen and many, many others, of course, and Abraham Maslow, were able to use and digest, or all myself, or some of the others. And we went on to complete. I graduated with, I think, magna cum laude. There were six of us that year, and highest honors. And I wrote, oh, you had to write a thesis. I wrote my thesis on Hart Crane's poetry. It was almost like getting a doctorate. It was a very stiff oral, and 6 hour written was not easy. And I will say it was an intellectually stimulating period. And I repeat, when you interaction between faculty and students was incredible. There were very few large classes. One of the few large classes was Professor Otto's Man and Nature, which was in the main auditorium in basketball and had 300 or 400, maybe 500 students. But most classes were small. I mean, by small, I mean small, 20, 30, 40, and smaller. And there's something bad about bigness. There is a curse of bigness, yes, yes. So many of the unconventionals finished their undergraduate work elsewhere. And I would say now the seven leisure time pursuits. The single individual that probably influenced me the most was the poet Delmore Schwartz. I influenced him and he influenced me. There was an interchange. I got him interested in Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud, which he was not at that time and knew very little about, and he began reading Politics and Psychiatry. I had begun reading Freud during the summer before I went to school. I had discovered him. And it was Delmore who really introduced me to T.S. Eliot, and Ezra Pound, and Wallace Stevens. And I discovered, and James Joyce. I hardly listened to the radio. I was one of the few people who liked films, especially during my freshman year. I was just a born film buff. People like Delmore, in those days, the aesthetes, which is, as I say, one of the circles I moved in, the Arden House group, Don Hayakawa, Delmore Schwartz, the aesthetes, looked down on movies. Movies were just Hollywood things. And didn't have the later and present respect for movies. And naturally, there was no such thing as communications courses or Department of Communications. There was a studio radio station, WHA, but I can't remember anybody listening to radio or talking about it. I personally went to films, and I remember again in my freshman year, one of the film theaters was showing the first version of An American Tragedy with the one with Sylvia Sidney. It was later done again with Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift, but this was an early one with Phillips Holmes and Sylvia Sidney. And the contest was, write an essay comparing the book, the movie, to the novel. And I wrote an essay, and I won. First prize was 10 pairs of tickets. And I remember having an awfully difficult time finding men and women to go with me to the movies. They scorned the movie so much. I found people, of course, but they weren't the usual people. Delmore wouldn't go to the movies. Later, strangely enough, he became a movie critic for the New Republic. The whole attitude toward movies, toward films, has shifted markedly. It is true that in those days, the foreign language departments would show in Bascom Hall German films, French films, and you have to realize that at that period, we're talking of 31, 32, even into 33 and maybe 34, foreign films were very rarely seen by Americans. There were not subtitles, so you had to have some smattering in the language to follow them. And again, it was a totally different experience. It was very personal. It wasn't a great big mass media experience. And it's hard to say. I remember by 1934, more and more people began going to the movies. I can remember people talking about Frank Capra movies, Like It Happened One Night, Mr. Deeds, goes to town, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, as one that people talked about and saw. Whether they influenced anybody, I don't know. The books that I remember being most influenced by were not current books. I'll tell you something interesting. At that time, the co-op, which sold clothes as well as books, had a section of illegal books. That is, books that were banned. And you could rent them for 25 cents a day. And among the books was Ulysses, James Joyce's great book, probably one of the most important works of fiction of the 20th century. They had that, and they had The Unexpurgated Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence. And I and somebody else I read, maybe he wouldn't want me to give his name, stole the book because it was a very hard book to read. We stole it from the co-op. And ultimately, this philosophy professor, whose name I just cannot remember, he went to the University of Chicago later and became a very well-known neoconservative philosopher. He paid us $25 for this book we had sold after we had both read it. But again, it's interesting. How many universities in 1932 would have had James Joyce's Ulysses on its shelves available to rent? So I would say the writings of Ulysses influenced me a great deal. And I almost kept my movie, my love of movies, as a secret vice. I liked westerns, action pictures, gangster pictures. Later on, subsequently, intellectuals and aesthetes would take up what they called genre films. But at that time, it was just a secret vice, like my love of jazz. And I would have violent arguments with some aesthetes, like Delmore Schwartz, on jazz, and I finally gave up. And I had two friends on the campus at that time who also loved jazz, and we played records that we had for each other. And by my junior year, I had a small turntable. I still didn't have a radio. So in your seventh question, yes, of course, tobacco. I didn't smoke pot, because pot was hardly known on the campus at that time, until after graduation, when I began to hang out with jazz musicians. So I'd say I smoked pot somewhere in 37, 38. But cigarette smoking was a sign of masculinity and sophistication or urbanity, and I certainly had begun smoking before I came to the campus, and smoked all during my undergraduate years. And of course, alcohol at first was a form of rebellion against society during the Prohibition period. So I first began drinking in speakeasies. When it was legalized, I drank a lot. Not heavily, but I knew several people who did. And there was certainly, it was a thing to do. Drugs, of course there were the drugs which you began hearing of later, such as the mind-altering drugs like LSD were unknown. I don't think they even made LSD. Aldous Huxley began writing about peyote and some of the other drugs of that sort much later on. And my first discovery of barbiturates came in my junior year, when I had a sleeping problem. And somebody in the student clinic, a doctor in the student clinic, prescribed, sodium amytal. And gave me two tablets, and they certainly made me sleepy. We hitchhiked a great deal, by the way. I'm remembering this because it was during a hitchhiking period. And to Chicago, to Milwaukee, all over, especially to Chicago. And It was nice. But there was, I don't remember people using uppers. I don't know whether even benzodrine and dexedrine were invented at that time. There were no tranquilizing drugs to speak of. As I say, they had some barbiturates already, but there were certainly plenty of guys who were already becoming or would become alcoholics. I must remember another very important person in my life was Ken W. Purdy. He and he had a sister, Mary Lois, who went on the staff of Life magazine later. Their father had written on Wisconsin, and I think he was allowed to come tuition free as a result. He and I became very close. We drank a lot together. We shared aspirations toward writing and journalism. And he became an extremely brilliant writer. He must have written as many as 10 or 15 books, many about automobiles. He wrote short stories for Playboy, many articles for Playboy. And he took his life. He became a severely depressed alcoholic, and despite his success and personal achievement, was just suffering from congenital depression and melancholy, and he took his life about 10 years ago, which was a great tragedy and a personal loss to him. But he epitomized the bohemian thing, and I remember when they first installed the carillons, which you'd have to get the date of, I think it was 32, 33, sneaked up and put on an impromptu concert illegally in the middle of the night. That was the sort of thing people did a lot of in those days. The leisure time, one of the things about sex in that period is I believe that before talked about the practices, there was such a great fear of pregnancy combined with the taboos on sex that, in my opinion, despite all the bragging, there was very little premarital sex practiced on campus. It is a very difficult thing to tell the truth from the false, but my opinion is there was not too much. There was some, perhaps more than other campuses, but it was not, certainly not widespread. The attitude toward it was, however, all the people who espoused the bohemian attitude, naturally free love was part of the bohemian attitude. At that time, it's a strange thing, most of the women who flowed into the radical and bohemian circles, as I would call it, were not physically attractive or charming. They weren't well-dressed. They didn't shower or bathe. I can only describe them. They're the sort of women that have hair on their upper lips, and they were gross and very unattractive. And I would often have the theory that they took up radical politics as their only chance to meet men. Now, it's possible that the men who were drawn into it were rejects and misfits in society. I don't know, but by and large, it was very rare to find an attractive woman among the political radicals, because that had changed drastically. However, among the aesthetes, the other group of bohemians, and on the cardinal, there was an entirely different story. Many were in sororities or in the dormitories like Barnard and Chadbourne, and were sophisticated, not just in the books they read and the artists they admired, but the clothes. And they did shower regularly and occasionally even wear cologne. I would say the big difference between the majority of the student body and the unconventional people, the difference would be among those in the student body who were, let's say, an engineering school and the agricultural school. That was the big difference, because these liberal arts students, whether they were fraternity members or lived in Haywood House, were very close in spirit. I may be oversimplifying it, but that's my feeling. It was kind of a homogeneity of spirit. Perhaps a fraternity, men would be more, would stress drinking more and sex parties more and football games more. But there was a camaraderie and a back and forth kidding around. By the way, I forgot to put in that one of my favorite pastimes, which again set me off from my aesthetic friends, was I loved gambling. I learned how to play bridge while I was a freshman there. I already was a poker player. And I sort of, that was a separate category of friends I had, the ones I played cards with. I had to have several vices, in quotation marks, which I kept secret from other people. My aesthetic friends didn't know I occasionally played cards. Anyhow, people who were agricultural students or people who were engineering students were sharply demarcated from the liberal arts students, and their attitudes, which were tending to be conventional, even right-wing, and perhaps even hatred of people who I think they tended to think of as New York Jews, and perhaps rightly so, because many of the people in Haywood House were New York Jews. They were, they probably had in their minds a stereotype of a New York Jew who was badly dressed and loud-voiced and argumentative and was atheistic and all the things that you could sum up by saying, that was how they thought, and they would have nothing to do with such people, and such people would have nothing to do with them. There was a tremendous gulf there. So, but among the other students, there was no problem. Of course, it's hard. I wasn't typical of the students because I had something in me that I was just, I moved from one group to another, and I don't know how I was able to do it, but I did it. It's hard for me to answer how the administration of the faculty viewed the Bohemians on the campus. You would have to get other people to know. I just would say this, I never felt any sense of being constrained or suffering because of what I did. And as I say, I was rather a public person because I wrote for the Cardinal. I'd been arrested twice. I was never called up to Dean Sellery, who was a Dean of the Arts and Letters, and historian. But these people were extraordinary teachers. They came from a school which loved and respected thinking and culture and study in a way that there probably are not too many professors today. Research was less important to them than scholarship. That's the word I'm on. Scholarship was important, but it took a second place to teaching. They loved teaching. They loved their students. They loved the University of Wisconsin and what it stood for, and the state of Wisconsin. Well, I think on the legislative investigations, I think you could get more of that from other people. It's just there was a John B. Chappell. A great deal has been written and published about him. I wasn't very personally involved at that time. As to the Greeks, I had a lot of friends who were Greeks. I remember borrowing a tuxedo from one. I went to the junior prom and took the lady I'd fallen in love with, Charlotte, whom I married several years later. I kind of liked fraternities and sororities. I wasn't a member, but I wrote columns defending them. I felt they brought a certain quality of, when at their best, of tradition to the campus. On the other hand, at their worst, it's Animal House, the film Animal House. No, I don't. Question 11. I don't think the student body did change between my arrival in 1931 and the graduation in 1934, except to the extent that there were, alcohol was legalized, perhaps there was more interest in films, but basically the Depression was still rampant. There were war clouds on the horizon, at least politically radical people thought that some sort of war was inevitable. There were peace demonstrations in 1988, which was 1936. It was a period of the Oxford Peace Pledge. I remember writing a very controversial column for the Cardinal in which I, alas, correctly predicted that when the war came, those who had demonstrated that they would never fight in a war would probably go and fight in the war, and they did. Perhaps revolt and rebellion were more accepted between 1931 and 1936. I think by 1936, jazz certainly was more acceptable. The Benny Goodman and swing era was beginning by 36, 37, because I would hear it on the radio. That's something I listened to on the radio a lot, was bands coming in from Chicago and other cities nearby. The big band period was upon us. So I don't think there was a significant change. The Cardinal still remained the great newspaper that it was, and the Cardinal didn't seriously change till the 1960s. I can't answer your question 12, what social and cultural elements made possible the blooming of Bohemia. I know that it had its roots in the 1920s. There were also small avant-garde magazines like The Rocking Horse. They're supposed to have been unconventional writers and poets. I'd hear about them on the campus. There was a long tradition of rebellion because of the La Follette family, because of professors like John R. Cummins. And I believe Thorsten Veblen once taught at the University of Wisconsin. And there was something about, you know, Wisconsin had, Milwaukee had a socialist mayor. It was a radical milieu. Now, why it came together, I don't know. I remember there were funny little restaurants with candles, lit by candles, several of those, I can't remember their names, on the side streets off State Street. I think what led to the demise of Bohemia was prosperity, paradoxically enough. First the war and then prosperity. When everybody has a car and everybody has a stereo, and everybody has clothes and money, and Bohemia has to be in struggle and conflict, and it does seem as if the media has chewed up and digested and swallowed everything, the free spirits, until they're no longer free. It's very difficult to be in. What are you going to rebel against when Rolling Stone, I mean the magazine, is ultra-radical. This big, successful, rich magazine is ultra-radical. And you have all the popular rock groups which make millions of dollars preaching rebellion, anarchism, and so forth. I imagine the only way one can be a radical nowadays is to be an ultra-conservative. I think these are some of the elements that led to its demise. And there's total freedom and anarchy in sex, in behavior, in everything, until the whirligig of taste swings around again. Bohemia seems to have conquered the world. To my knowledge, there were little enclaves of Bohemians on every campus. City College, I believe, had something. There was something at the University of Michigan, at the University of Chicago. Minnesota had a few. I know very little about them. Barry, I hope this will help you in your historical project, and perhaps someday we can meet. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help, and I think the more you delve into it, the more fascinating you will find it. God bless you.